Chapter 67. Descending from the table, she left the parlor and went upstairs, intending to enter the room overhead, which was the bedchamber at the back of the drawing room. But, nerveless woman as she had now become, she could not bring herself to attempt the handle. She listened. The dead silence within was broken only by a regular beat. Drip, drip, drip. Mrs. Brooks hastened downstairs, opened the front door, and ran into the street. A man she knew, one of the workmen employed at an adjoining villa, was passing by, and she begged him to come in and go upstairs with her. She feared something had happened to one of her lodgers. The workman assented and followed her to the landing. She opened the door of the drawing room and stood back for him to pass in, entering herself behind him. The room was empty, the breakfast a substantial repast of coffee, eggs, and a cold ham lay spread upon the table untouched, as when he had taken it up, excepting that the carving knife was missing. She asked the man to go through the folding doors into the adjoining room. He opened the doors, entered a step or two, and came back almost instantly with a rigid face. "Why, good God, the gentleman in bed is dead. I think he has been hurt with a knife. A lot of blood had run down upon the floor." The alarm was soon given, and the house which had lately been so quiet resounded with the tramp of many footsteps, a surgeon among the rest. The wound was small, but the point of the blade had touched the heart of the victim, who lay on his back, pale, fixed, dead, as if he had scarcely moved after the infliction of the blow. In a quarter of an hour the news that a gentleman who was a temporary visitor to the town had been stabbed in his bed spread through every street and villa of the popular watering place. LVII, meanwhile, Angel Clare had walked automatically along the way by which he had come, and, entering his hotel, sat down over the breakfast, staring at nothingness. He went on eating and drinking unconsciously till on a sudden he demanded his bill, having paid which he took his dressing bag in his hand, the only luggage he had brought with him, and went out. At the moment of his departure a telegram was handed to him, a few words from his mother, stating that they were glad to know his address, and informing him that his brother Cuthbert had proposed to and been accepted by Mercy Chant. Clare crumpled up the paper and followed the route to the station. Reaching it, he found that there would be no train leaving for an hour and more. He sat down to wait, and having waited a quarter of an hour felt that he could wait there no longer. Broken in heart and numbed, he had nothing to hurry for, but he wished to get out of a town which had been the scene of such an experience, and turned to walk to the first station onward, and let the train pick him up there. The highway that he followed was open, and at a little distance dipped into a valley, across which it could be seen running from edge to edge. He had traversed the greater part of this depression, and was climbing the western acclivity, when, pausing for breath, he unconsciously looked back. Why he did, so he could not say, but something seemed to impel him to the act. The tape-like surface of the road diminished in his rear as far as he could see, and as he gazed a moving spot intruded on the white vacuity of its perspective. It was a human figure running. Clare waited, with a dim sense that somebody was trying to overtake him. The form descending the incline was a woman's, yet so entirely was his mind blinded to the idea of his wife's following him, that even when she came nearer he did not recognize her under the totally changed attire in which he now beheld her. It was not till she was quite close that he could believe her to be Tess. "I saw you turn away from the station just before I got there, and I have been following you all this way." She was so pale, so breathless, so quivering in every muscle, that he did not ask her a single question, but seizing her hand, and pulling it within his arm, he led her along. To avoid meeting any possible wayfarers he left the high road, and took a footpath under some fir trees. When they were deep among the moaning boughs he stopped and looked at her inquiringly. "Angel," she said, as if waiting for this, "do you know what I have been running after you for? To tell you that I have killed him." A pitiful white smile lit her face as she spoke. What? Said he, thinking from the strangeness of her manner that she was in some delirium. I have done it, I don't know how, she continued. Still, I owed it to you, and to myself, Angel. I feared long ago, when I struck him on the mouth with my glove, that I might do it someday for the trap he set for me in my simple youth, and his wrong to you through me. He has come between us and ruined us, and now he can never do it any more. I never loved him at all, Angel, as I loved you. You know it, don't you? You believe it? You didn't come back to me, and I was obliged to go back to him. Why did you go away? Why did you when I loved you so? I can't think why you did it. But I don't blame you. Only, Angel, will you forgive me my sin against you, now I have killed him? I thought as I ran along, that you would be sure to forgive me now I have done that. It came to me as a shining light, that I should get you back that way. I could not bear the loss of you any longer. You don't know how entirely I was unable to bear your not loving me. Say you do now, dear, dear husband. Say you do, now I have killed him. I do love you, Tesso, I do it has all come back, he said, tightening his arms round her with fervid pressure. Be but how do you mean you have killed him? I mean that I have, she murmured in a reverie. What, bodily? Is he dead? Yes. He heard me crying about you, and he bitterly taunted me, and called you by a foul name. And then I did it. My heart could not bear it. He had nagged me about you before. And then I dressed myself, and came away to find you. By degrees he was inclined to believe that as he had faintly attempted, at least, what she said as he had done, and his horror at her impulse was mixed with amazement at the strength of her affection for himself, and at the strangeness of its quality, which had apparently extinguished her moral sense altogether. Unable to realize the gravity of her conduct, she seemed at last content, and he looked at her as she lay upon his shoulder, weeping with happiness, and wondered what obscure strain in the d'Urberville blood had led to this aberration, if it were an aberration. There momentarily flashed through his mind that the family tradition of the coach and murder might have arisen because the d'Urbervilles had been known to do these things. As well as his confused and excited ideas could reason, he supposed that in the moment of mad grief, of which she spoke, her mind had lost its balance, and plunged her into this abyss. It was very terrible if true, if a temporary hallucination, sad. But, anyhow, here was this deserted wife of his, this passionately fond woman, clinging to him without a suspicion that he would be anything to her but a protector. He saw that for him to be otherwise was not, in her mind, within the region of the possible. Tenderness was absolutely dominant in Claire at last. He kissed her endlessly with his white lips, and held her hand, and said, I will not desert you. I will protect you by every means in my power, dearest love, whatever you may have done, or not have done. They then walked on under the trees, Tess turning her head every now and then to look at him. Worn and unhandsome as he had become, it was plain that she did not discern the least fault in his appearance. To her he was, as of old, all that was perfection, personally and mentally. He was still her Antinous, her Apollo even. His sickly face was beautiful as the morning to her affectionate regard on this day, no less than when she first beheld him. For was it not the face of the one man on earth who had loved her purely, and who had believed in her as pure? With an instinct, as to possibilities he did not now, as he had intended, make for the first station beyond the town, but plunged still farther under the firs, which here abounded for miles. Each clasping the other round the waist they promenaded over the dry bed of fir needles, thrown into a vague intoxicating atmosphere at the consciousness of being together at last, with no living soul between them, ignoring that there was a corpse. Thus they proceeded for several miles till Tess, arousing herself, looked about her, and said, timidly, are we going anywhere in particular? I don't know, dearest. Why? I don't know. Well, we might walk a few miles further, and when it is evening find lodging somewhere, or other in the lonely cottage, perhaps. Can you walk well, Tessie?
Oh yes.
I could walk forever and ever with your arm round me. Upon the whole it seemed a good thing to do. Thereupon they quickened their pace, avoiding high roads, and following obscure paths tending more or less northward. But there was an unpractical vagueness in their movements throughout the day. Neither one of them seemed to consider any question of effectual escape, disguise, or long concealment. Their every idea was temporary and unforefending, like the plans of two children. At midday they drew near to a roadside inn, and Tess would have entered it with him to get something to eat, but he persuaded her to remain among the trees and bushes of this half woodland, half moorland part of the country, till he should come back. Her clothes were of recent fashion, even the ivory-handled parasol that she carried was of a shape unknown in the retired spot to which they had now wandered. And the cut of such articles would have attracted attention in the settle of a tavern. He soon returned, with food enough for half a dozen people, and two bottles of wine enough to last them for a day or more, should any emergency arise. They sat down upon some dead boughs, and shared their meal. Between 1 and 2 o'clock they packed up the remainder, and went on again. "I feel strong enough to walk any distance," said she. "I think we may as well steer in a general way towards the interior of the country, where we can hide for a time, and are less likely to be looked for than anywhere near the coast," Claire remarked. "Later on, when they have forgotten us, we can make for some port." She made no reply to this beyond that of grasping him more tightly, and straight inland they went. Though the season was an English May, the weather was serenely bright, and during the afternoon it was quite warm. Through the latter miles of their walk their footpath had taken them into the depths of the New Forest, and towards evening, turning the corner of a lane, they perceived behind a brook and bridge a large board on which was painted in white letters, "This desirable mansion to be let furnished. Particulars following, with directions to apply to some London agents." Passing through the gate they could see the house, an old brick building of regular design and large accommodation.
"I know it," said Claire.
"T is Bramshurst Court. You can see that it is shut up, and grass is growing on the drive."
"Some of the windows are open," said Tess.
"Just to air the rooms, I suppose. All these rooms empty, and we without a roof to our heads."
"You are getting tired, my Tess," he said.
"He'll stop soon." And kissing her sad mouth he again led her onwards. He was growing weary likewise, for they had wandered 12 or 15 miles, and it became necessary to consider what they should do for rest. They looked from afar at isolated cottages and little inns, and were inclined to approach one of the latter, when their hearts failed them, and they sheered off. At length their gait dragged, and they stood still.
"Could we sleep under the trees?" she asked.
He thought the season insufficiently advanced.
"I have been thinking of that empty mansion we passed," he said.
"Let us go back towards it again." They retraced their steps, but it was half an hour before they stood without the entrance gate as earlier. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.